I am very happy to have Keith Alverson address us today. He's got so much experience and has been engaged in I think you were going to talk, Keith, weren't you, a little bit of background about your farm and the transition? He and his family have been farming their 2,700 plus acres for six generations. And over that time, I see there you have a picture, it looks like probably your grandfather and your father mm-hmm. and you and probably your sons. And he's also been very involved with the South Dakota Corn Growers Association and the National Corn Growers Association, holding leadership positions in both of those organizations. He served as chairman of the National Corn Association's Ethanol Committee, a liaison to the National Corn Growers Association Stewardship Action Team, as well as representing them by speaking on climate and soil health issues at the Soil Health Institute's release of their Soil Health Action Plan. It looks like you've also spoken at COP21 in Paris on these issues. He's currently a member of the Corn Growers Association Board of Directors, and he represents them too and serves on the Board of Directors of Field to Market, which is the Alliance for Sustainable Agriculture. And he is chairman of the National Corn Growers Association's Climate Task Force. So he's definitely got the cred there. And in this presentation, Keith is going to talk about his experience with farming practices that have sequestered carbon on the farm, in the soil, and that their relation to soil health and the economics of the farm going forward. So, and I think you're going to also touch on what the National Corn Growers Association is doing on soil health and climate, I think, nationally.
All right. Well, thank you, Jan. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to all you folks and I appreciate the interactions that we've had up in the lead up to this. And so really looking forward to the conversation and telling you a little bit about myself and my experience from the perspective of a South Dakota corn farmer. And so you'd mentioned you can see my slides. I've got a slide deck here. And I guess I titled the topic of my talk, since I identify myself as a corn grower, even before I got involved in the Corn Growers Associations, I titled it Corn, the Convergence of Carbon, Climate, and Soil Health. Based on some of the experiences that we've had here in South Dakota and on our farm. You'd mentioned that I myself am a sixth generation farmer. We haven't farmed all 2,700 acres for that six generations in South Dakota, but as we've added generations and me coming back to the farm, we have expanded in the past. And so you can see I've got a picture of four of the generations, I guess potentially the seventh there standing flanking my grandfather, and then a picture of my family, in the lower right-hand corner. And so, as Jan said, we farm about 2,700 acres now. I've been back to the farm full-time since 2002 when I graduated with an agronomy degree from South Dakota State University. We've got a mix of irrigated and dry land acres here in southeast South Dakota near a little town called Chester. And so we're about 45 miles northwest of kind of the point on the map where Minnesota, South Dakota, and Iowa kind of all meet together. And so kind of in the I-29 or the Interstate 29 corridor here along the eastern side of the state. Got a mix of dry land and irrigated acres that has given us, different experiences in the past where we've got some glacial outwash and real gravelly soils over about a third of our farm. And the rest of it's clay-based. And so that in itself has brought on some different management challenges and opportunities. And so one of the things that we've done is we've focused in on a practice called ridge till over the last 30-plus years, something my dad and uncle had implemented, something to kind of have a happy medium in these northern climates in regards to a combination of no-till and then still being able to have the soil warm up in the spring, just because we stay so cool so late being this far north. We've also tried to implement a lot of precision ag or precision technologies on our farm, going back to yield maps, starting off and variable rate planting, variable rate fertilizer application, variable rate nozzles on sprayers and things along that line. And so I'll talk a little bit about those things, but we really try and adapt to some of the new technology around the farm. We think that's allowed us to be better stewards. And then, also helped in our effort around building soil carbon and organic matter on our farm. And so here's just a little bit of an overview of what goes on in the ridge till system. As you can see in the left-hand side, that's a picture of our planter going through the field. And so it's real similar to no-till. We're going through and we're planting into last year's corn stalks. We really like having that heavy residue cover, protects the soil from wind and water erosion, all that potential, and helps provide a nice environment for the microorganisms, et cetera, that we have going on in the soil. On the lower right is what goes on right after we've built the ridges in our fields. That takes place in the summer months, where we go through with a row crop cultivator and move a little bit of soil back up around the corn roots. And then as we go through the year, you can see I kind of went through it in reverse order, but you can see the planter moves a little bit of soil off the top of the ridge, and we just basically no-till right into that planting surface. And so, being this far north, it's critical to have a little bit of a black strip there that absorbs sunlight and can actually get it warm enough for corn to germinate, corn and soybeans to germinate, in early spring to maximize on productivity. At the end of the year, and this is a picture of post-harvest on our farm, this is what all of our corn fields look like. Real heavy mat of residue left on the field, and as I said, that helps, keeps the soil cool, prevents erosion, and then provides energy to all the little microorganisms that are out there in the soil. The way that we have some of this residue gets incorporated in through the year is through earthworm activity. And so on the next slide, I've got a picture of where the earthworms will actually take this residue down in what they call middens. And that helps incorporate this residue at depth. I'm going to see if hopefully this video works, where it'll show us pulling out some of the residue that the earthworms are pulling down into those. Not getting the video to work. But anyway, I can describe it briefly. We're able to pull out where the earthworms have actually drug these corn stalks down into their holes. And the piece of residue that we pull out is about 6 or 8 inches long. And so they really work hard, and we've actually seen them up on the edge of the corn plants pulling down stalks when the corn's out standing in the field towards the end of the year. So they really do a nice job of incorporating this residue into our soil and kind of do our tillage and our nutrient movement and all those things. They do a lot of the work for us. So through the 30 plus years of ridge till, my dad and uncle started ridge tilling back in the early 80s. And we've left all this residue on the surface. We've been very careful with use of precision technology to manage our nutrient applications, to put things in the right place at the right time. All our fields are zone managed, where we will go out and do soil testing and apply only the nutrients that are needed in the areas of the field that they're needed in order to try to maximize economic return and environmental return on those areas. And we thought that, throughout this time, we wondered if we were really making an impact and changes on our soils. And so what I've got here is a couple maps that we made a couple years ago with a machine called a Veris, where it measures the electrical conductivity. And it also has an optical mapper that can measure variations in organic matter content. And one of the things that really stood out here, as you can see on the left picture, is this is a pivot irrigated field, and you can see the dry land corners. You can see the little red triangles come out of the corners where we've seen that we've made an impact. And you know, the big difference between the irrigated and non-irrigated areas is a significant amount of yield and residue, and plant biomass are directly correlated. And so bigger yields mean bigger residue. And that returning that to the soil has changed the dynamics of some of the soil taking place there to make it not only more stable, but ultimately more productive. And I'll talk about a little bit of the economics around what we see in return from that later on. And so, as I mentioned, zone management, we use GPS and other guidance tools to us to really do precise application, precise driving of equipment, you know, down to the sub-inch accuracy. A couple of years ago, we went to individual nozzle control on sprayers, which also helps us be better stewards by, you know, shutting off every 20 inches of the sprayer. And so we were very careful not to have any overlaps into areas that we don't want to have herbicide or pesticide applications being made. And then Ed mentioned recently, we've added the Veris machine to measure electrical conductivity and organic matter levels, which have to be baselined off of ground truthing tests. One of the things that we've looked back through in time is when my dad and uncle started ridge tilling, they took some soil tests, or it took several soil tests. That's a common practice around the farm, is to take soil tests on occasion. And we use it for nutrient management, to know what's in the soil and know what we should be applying based on, you know, agronomic calculations. And so they took some, you know, as they began ridge tilling. And as I came back from college, we started to pick up the pace of doing more soil sampling. We went to zone management and soil testing, you know, on bigger sections of the field more often. And one of the things that really piqued our interest was just how much we noticed our organic matter levels changing over a long period of time. And so you can see the bar graph that I've had here from the early 80s, which was right when they started building or doing ridge till, and then the 2010, so over the last 8 years, where we've seen the difference in our organic matter levels go. And even though, you know, going from 2.67 to 4.71 sounds small, real small changes actually have an extremely large impact on the soil, and then the amount of carbon that we have stored within our soils. And so, and as you can see, this is only the 0 to 6 inch sample range, which is really right up at the surface. And that's where a lot of the nutrient testing is done. But, you know, there's obviously potential for carbon to be stored deeper than that, you know, through earthworm activity and roots going down that deep. And so seeing this, we got to thinking back, you know, what actually is having this impact. We knew that through studies that reductions in tillage and doing high residue crops are a couple of things. And so we wanted to kind of try and think through what all was taking place on our farm. And about that time, I came across this image. And I don't know, you know, maybe this is a familiar image to many of you, but this is from 2013, a study from NASA's Goddard Space Institute. And what they did is they were able to find a way to track luminescence of plant material and track it back to photosynthetic activity. And what stands out to me as a corn farmer in this picture is where we see that bright intensity. You know, that's right across the Corn Belt to the United States. And this picture was taken in July. And so it may not be impactful in your mind, but this was something that stood out real starkly when I first saw this. And what NASA had discovered here is that even though, you know, once they tracked it across 365 days, the photosynthetic activity in the northern hemisphere, where we have seasons, you know, winter and summer and spring and summer, it was not quite as large as what they see in the tropics, where they have photosynthesis going on year round. But the intensity of this that's shown here in this image of the Corn Belt was actually 40% greater than that of the Amazon. And so, as I mentioned, for me as a corn farmer, it really stood out because this is what's going on in July around the Corn Belt. We've just went through a period of extreme growth in the corn plant. Corn's a C4 crop, they're renowned for their photosynthetic activity. And over the course from the beginning of July to mid or late July, even starting in late June, kind of a period of 3 to 4 weeks, the corn crop goes from about knee high to well over head high, sometimes up to 13 feet high. And so that's maximum growth period for the vegetative stage as it moves into the reproductive stage, where here's a picture of a field that's just tasseled. And so that's really what's going on in our cornfields at that time. And so that's when that peak photosynthetic activity is taking place. And really, corn's ability to kind of be a great big solar collector, taking that sunlight and converting that into energy and vegetation, and building up carbon within its plant. And so I'd mentioned the 0 to 6 inch soil samples that we did early on. And then, knowing that information, knowing how the earthworms work, and seeing some studies from ag research services across our ag research stations that USDA has, we got to wonder, is the organic matter increase that we've seen just in our topsoil, or does it actually go deeper? And one of the things that we've looked at throughout time is that, we know that when the prairies were plowed, there was organic matter and there was carbon stocks lost across the United States. And so that's one of the things that we in row crop agriculture have always been compared back against is, the prairies and how pristine and the amount of carbon and organic matter levels that they had. And so we wanted to try and do a comparison on what we'd seen in the buildup on our farm versus what we, more native areas in our area. And so what we did is we carefully identified a specific soil type on our farm under three different management practices and did some soil test bores to try and make a comparison and carefully measure those based on depth. You can see the three different landscape types. We had the irrigated ridge till corn for 24 years out of the 31 years growing there, and then soybeans for 7 years, which, we tend to have about a 2/3 to 3/4 corn and then about 1/4 soybeans in our crop rotation. I forgot to mention that earlier, but we've focused in on being able to grow corn. It's been pretty productive in our environment. Then also we've got pasture, which has been grazed since about 1900, and then meadow that has seldomly been grazed. So we wanted to take a look at the different levels in the organic matter buildup. And so as you can see, at the surface level, the 0 to 7 on the left, the cropland was towards the lower end. We had meadow up at the top, and then the pasture that had some grazing done was kind of right in the middle. And this wasn't necessarily to be unexpected, because we know that through that continuous grass, the perennial plant, that there's a buildup of organic matter at the surface, and the soil surface stays cool because it never gets black, and we never have we always have residue cover. But what really interested us was we saw that as we moved deeper into the profile, the cropland actually picked up and surpassed what we saw out of the pasture and was equal to what we saw in the meadow. And going to the 12 to 18 inch range, we were, had the organic matter levels the same as the meadow as well. And so with an annual crop, we think the benefit, that the corn plant can provide is that those roots go down that deep. And then at the end of the year, the roots will die off and become carbon stocks within the soil, while the perennials don't necessarily deposit that much. And so once we get to that level as well, the the potential for that carbon stock to stay in place is much greater because we don't have the oxygen interaction that you would right up on the surface. And so here's some information from USDA Ag Research Service. Just going through the different crop types, or three different predominant crops that we have. And then, as I'd mentioned, you know, we know that as we do tillage, the potential for carbon loss is increased. And, you know, also is a factor is what kind of return that we have to the soil. And I showed you the picture of a corn plants tasseling and just how much residue is out there. And we just don't necessarily have that with some of these other crops that we have in rotation. And so the map shows stover production, which is, you know, something that's attributable to yield, and how that's built up over time with corn. And through the late 50s, as hybrid seed and more technology came into our seed and the breeding processes were improved, they were able to grow more and more yield and bigger plants with corn. And so we've reached a point as of the mid-90s, where each year the corn plants were returning more carbon to the system than what is lost through even a chisel till pack, chisel tillage, you know, which is a common tillage practice across the Corn Belt. Here's some more information from USDA that just kind of shows the difference, and a bar line there where it's the minimum carbon needed to maintain. And that's with tillage in the system. And so you can see, as we look into crop rotations, corn is the one that's returning the residue to the system. We also have carbon to nitrogen ratios that many of you probably are pretty familiar with. And that goes into the stability of having that residue stay intact. The closer that the carbon to nitrogen ratios are to 1:1, the less stable it is and more easily broken down. And corn and wheat have extremely high carbon to nitrogen ratios and so are pretty stable within the soil. And so all that information kind of led us into wanting to do an even more intensive study on our farm of where exactly we are with carbon levels within our soil. And so we hired a firm called Applied Ecological Services in 2015 to do a carbon baseline on our farm. And so what we did, we identified two of the predominant soils on our farm. We took many soil cores across most of our fields and some neighboring fields and different land management scenarios. And so as you can see, we've got some ridge plant fields that were ones that the family has owned, and my dad and uncle have operated for those 32 years that we've been in ridge till. We've got native pastures that would be pastures in the area along creeks, et cetera, where it would be, you know, a grassland that's never been disturbed or broken historically. We've got some shorter term ridge till fields, which would be representative of what fields that I've taken over or farms that I've brought into operation or under our management since I came back from college. CRP fields, which, you know, is the Conservation Reserve Program, which are grasslands, historically in crop production, but then converted to grasslands. And then a 50-50 rotation with a pretty common tillage practice of the area with chisel till. And so, well, the numbers may mean things to some, I guess the overall picture is here is that through the 32 years of ridge till, we've nearly reached the carbon stock levels in the 0 to 36 inch profile of the native pasture and are approaching that in the ridge till of you know, the 16 year term. Whereas you compare the corn soy rotation with tillage, it's dramatically higher. And so all in the calculations that we've been able to go through, this accounts for about 1.5 tons of carbon per acre per year over those 32 years that we've sequestered, documented by the buildup of organic matter levels in our soils. And we think, you know, a large part of that is the reductions in tillage that we have through the use of ridge till, and the amount of corn, or the frequency of corn in our rotation, because of the sheer amount of carbon that we return to the soil in form of stover, as I showed you in some of those graphs earlier. And so in our minds, making these soil carbon budgets is just like balancing our checkbook. Are we returning more to the soil than what's being lost to the environment? And we do know that this varies from region to region. I've got inherent advantages in South Dakota that folks in southern Iowa may not have, but they've got opportunities that I might not have. A lot of discussion has been going on about cover crops and their benefits, and those are, there's great benefit in cover crop, especially in certain regions. There are things that we haven't been able to be successful at just due to the length of our growing season. A lot of times we'll plant our corn in late April, and we'll actually have snow falling on some of our first planted corn. And it's always a rush to make sure that we have enough growing units to have the crop reach maturity before we freeze and, the plants stop growing in the fall. So differences in climate, cool and moist versus warm and dry, all impact on how much carbon we can retain in our soil and what kind of return is required to actually build this up. Crop yields, I mentioned, the crop yields are directly correlated to what we have going on within the soil and the yields and, the residue amount that returns. And then, of course, tillage intensity. Tillage intensity is reduced all across the Corn Belt, but we still have varying degrees of how intense some of the tillage is done. Historically, there was a lot of moldboard plowing, and a lot of that was to handle weed and pest pressure, where with no-till, we've got the use of glyphosate and others, in our biotech crops that have allowed for reductions in tillage, which have been a great benefit to lower till practices across the United States. And so I promised a little bit of soil health math in regards to what we see on our farm. I just wanted to preface it with saying that, Monsanto is a major tech provider that provides seed traits that are used, across the Corn Belt. And, we'd find the same thing from our other seed trait providers, but their estimation that I used here as a quote was that for each acre inch of water, we can produce about 10 bushels an acre. And roughly on average, when you add a percent of organic matter, we can hold about 1.43 acre inches of water, and we're finding out now through some testing that this can vary by soil type, on exactly how many acre inches of water we can have in that 1% of organic matter. But so if we go through the math, that 1% of organic matter increase, and we grew that over that on our farm, will net you about 14 bushels of corn. And so if you just look at the December corn price today, that's about an annual return of about $55 an acre through the practices that we've been able to implement over the last 30 years. We also know that there's mineralization that takes place of that organic matter, and that releases nutrients that are available to our crops that we would have otherwise had to apply as synthetic nutrients. And so there's some nutrient cycling that takes place, and just putting values on those, I add up the some of the major nutrients that we need for corn production and corn and row crop production, nitrogen, sulfur, phosphorus, and potassium, and you can see they total up to about another $10 an acre. And so we think on an annual return, each percent of organic matter that we can build will be about an annual return on average of around $65 an acre, which is, just incredible, and can certainly be the difference between profitability and non-profitability, especially in the times that we're in row crop agriculture, where, a lot of prices are at break even for farmers. Just wanted to throw up a picture of my kids. Jan had mentioned earlier that, and I'd mentioned I'm the sixth generation and we're raising hopefully the seventh generation. And this is why my family has been so focused on soil health and conservation, is that, you know, it's one of the things that we've inherently known within our family and been passed down is, you know, if we take care of the soil is going to take care of us as a family and as a farm. And I certainly think that passes along into the environment around us. And so that's why I'm excited to have the conversation that we're having tonight and to be involved in some of the things that I've been able to be involved in for the Corn Growers Association. So next, I'll talk a little bit about the Soil Health Partnership, which is an initiative that the National Corn Growers had started a few years ago, but briefly, the National Corn Growers Association, we've got about 40,000 dues-paying members. We're an advocacy organization for a policy that improves the lives for corn farmers, and we've got about 49 affiliated either checkoff or grower associations across the Corn Belt. You know, our mission is to create and increase opportunities for corn farmers, and our vision is to sustainably feed and fuel a growing world. And so one of the things that we've done this by is through the creation of the Soil Health Partnership, where we can focus in on the soil health measurements and data collection to try and help pass on that value to farmers and to be able to spread the message on some of the practices that that are taking place out there in the countryside. And so this was done in partnership with both Monsanto and the Walton Family Foundation. And we do have a robust degree of partners within there, including the Nature Conservancy and the Environmental Defense Fund, others that have contributed either through the scientific process or recommendations and advisory process. And so there's a robust science advisory board that takes place with a lot of academics across the Corn Belt. The basis of the Soil Health Partnership is we've created, now we're up over 111 research farms or practicing farms where they would take field and do split management. The early work that we've tried to focus in on is comparative analysis of cover crops, conservation tillage, and advanced nutrient management. And, you know, only farmers were accepted to this point that were willing to make a practice change on a percentage of their acres. And so we wanted to develop research protocols to actually do some record keeping and determine what was going on within the soils as these practice changes were made, and then be able to put all that information together and bring it back, you know, to present to farmers and then publish it in research journals. And so you can see here's a little bit of a layout of where the farms are for the most part across the traditional Corn Belt. Since we're, you know, in charge of it, that we focused in on where the corn is being grown and where a lot of our ag production land for row crops is in the United States. And so I talked about establishment of research protocols, you know, and some of the areas that we focused in on early in the cover crops and the tillage and the advanced nutrient management. But the intent ultimately is to have publishable results and to determine long-term and short-term trends on what we have going on within the soil in order to bring that back to farmers. And so all those research protocols are used across the network sites. So in regards to the outcomes for farmers, you know, we wanted to link them to analytical tools in the toolbox for farmers and to bring that information back there. And so we can learn these things across the broad areas. So we know that precision research is something that, being able to gather information using GPS and GIS technology is something that we've been able to take advantage of. And, you know, just like we have with our personal computers and our phones, the ability to collect data and analyze data is just incredible in what's going on in the farm world. And so to be able to bring all that information back and really do data analytics in order to determine what's having the impact and where in regards to these soil health measures And part of doing this is we tie the dollars and cents together with the practice changes and the impacts that we have on soil colloids and the aggregate stability, things along that line, soil features, and have that presented back to the farmers and try and put dollars and cents into these demonstrated changes and how that's going to improve their bottom line. And one of the ways that we know as a farmer, one of the ways that we use for learning is talking to one another and trying to learn what best practices are taking place. And so that's all shared on the farmer-to-farmer type network. And so just briefly, the other work that I've done for NCGA, as Jan mentioned, I'm currently the chairman of NCGA's Climate Task Force. And so we knew that discussions around climate and the impacts and what changes are occurring have been taking place. We haven't always been as involved as maybe we should have been in the past. And that's something that we took note of. And so we created a task force to have these discussions to kind of get our growers caught up to speed on what research is out there, and then really make recommendations back to our governing board, which I also sit on how best to move forward and engage in these conversations as they come up as we go forward. I had the privilege of speaking at the Soil Health Institute in their rollout of the soil health indicators, gave a similar discussion to what you're hearing here tonight, just about our family history and focus in on soil health and just the excitement that we have around that in agriculture right now. Something I think, is a buzzword in agriculture. Also was able to talk at COP21. On behalf of agriculture, to talk about collaborative partnerships that we've had and things like the Soil Health Partnership, et cetera, and just how that works to help drive change across agriculture in a positive measure. Within NCGA, we work on various other issues, the Farm Bill, the conservation title that has opportunities for stewardship and carbon-related practices. Sustainability is one that I've worked on to a great degree. That can mean a lot of things to different people. But long-term economic and environmental sustainability is something very important to corn growers. North American Climate Smart Ag group is another group that NCGA is a member of. We've engaged there on climate smart agriculture. We've worked on sustainability issues like life cycle analysis, and I've worked on that a great deal through my work on ethanol, where we, carbon accounting for the life cycle of ethanol and its production process is something that I've focused in on. And we have markets out there as corn farmers that are dependent upon our carbon impact on the atmosphere. And, through the Renewable Fuel Standard is the RFS, and the Low Carbon Fuel Standard that we have in California and some other states now. And so that's kind of in a nutshell what some of the work that I've done on NCGA and a lot about my farm and what we've been able to witness. And so then I would, gladly move into the question time period. But I did want to point out that, if there's any information about our farm that piqued your interest, my family and I had a website put together that's listed there is www.carbonharmony.org. And so certainly answers to more questions there.
Okay, thank you. Wow, that was a lot of information. Thank you. Hopefully we'll talk again.
Yeah, sounds great.